Welcome to the reading of the Courier Journal for Saturday, February 4th, 2023, which is brought to our Louisville listeners via Louisville Public Media. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Your reader for today is Melody Ryan. We'll begin with the WHAS local forecast. Milder weather will grace us for the weekend. Saturday will start sunny, but clouds will increase throughout the afternoon. Temperatures will be in the middle 40s with breezy southwest winds at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Temperatures Sunday will jump into the middle 50s with winds increasing to 20 to 30 miles per hour from the southwest. Monday will be sunny with highs in the mid 50s. A rainier weather pattern is set to arrive Tuesday. Today, high 47, increasing clouds. Tonight, low 38, cold. Sunday, high 54, low 32, mild and windy. Monday, high 56, low 45, very pleasant. Tuesday, high 60, low 42, late showers. Wednesday, high 55, low 44, rain. Thursday, high 58, low 43, rain. Two selected to fill seats on Metro Council. New members Rashad and Baker both work for JCPS by Billy Coben. The Louisville Metro Council appointed two new members Thursday evening to fill vacant seats, and they both work for Jefferson County Public Schools. Metro Council members voted to appoint Kumar Rashad and Philip Baker to represent Districts 3 and 6, respectively. Rashad is the mathematics chair at Breckenridge Metropolitan High School, an alternative school in JCPS, and he serves with the Jefferson County Teachers Association, Kentucky Education Association, and National Council of Urban Education Associations. Rashad is also an Alcohol Beverage Control Office administrator for Shively. Baker works for JCPS as a family resource coordinator at Coleridge Taylor Montessori Elementary. He also works for State Farm Insurance as a line agent, an office manager, and as a legal assistant, along with holding a youth enrichment and community outreach director position at Christ Way Missionary Baptist Church. Baker is also a board member for the Kentucky Derby Festival, the chair of the Greater Louisville Association of Democrats, and was the campaign chair for his predecessor, David James, after dropping out of that race and supporting James in 2010. Baker previously ran for the State House of Representatives as well. Both men are Democrats. They replaced Democrats Keisha Dorsey and James, both of whom joined new Louisville Mayor Craig Greenberg's administration. Dorsey, who represented District 3 since 2018, is now Greenberg's Deputy Chief of Staff, and James is Deputy Mayor for Emergency Services. James, who represented District 6, has been Metro Council President since 2018. District 3 includes Shively and several West End neighborhoods. District 6 includes part of downtown and surrounding neighborhoods such as Limerick, Old Louisville, Park Hill, Shelby Park, Smoketown, and Russell. Baker said Tuesday his top priorities are improving public safety, supporting elderly residents, and the several senior living facilities in District 6, and helping youth. Rashad said he would like to boost home ownership and change zoning regulations to bring more services to the district and keep out additional liquor stores and strip clubs. If there are more liquor stores than libraries, then there's a problem, Rashad said Monday. Eight applicants for the District 3 seat answered questions from Metro Council members Monday as part of the interview process, and 20 applicants initially sought the District 6 seat before six withdrew ahead of Tuesday interviews. Both Rashad and Baker are Black, as are their predecessors. Before Thursday's meeting, Louisville NAACP President Raoul Cunningham sent a letter to council members asking that you do not reduce African-American representation on the council. Cunningham reminded members that during merger negotiations, we sought to make certain that the election process would ensure African-American representation in the newly created Metro Council be equivalent and reflective of that same representation in the Board of Aldermen. Each of the new members received a comfortable majority of the votes from Metro Council. For District 3, several Republicans voted for human resource professional Trayshawn Sean Spencer, and two Democrats, Cassie Chambers Armstrong and Ja'Cory Arthur, voted for vocal Kentucky leader Shamika Parrish Wright. For District 6, Metro Councilman Pat Mulville, Democrat 10th, voted for Fairness Campaign Leader Chris Hartman, and Metro Councilwoman Cindy Fowler, Democrat 14th, voted for Stephen Peterson, who has a pharmacy background. The new members join a 26-member Metro Council that features 17 Democrats and 9 Republicans. If they wish to keep serving on Metro Council into next year, both must run again in special elections this November. And since all even-numbered districts are on the ballot in 2024, the District 6 seat will see a primary and general election next year. Metro Council may have yet another vacancy to fill if Metro Councilwoman Cassie Chambers Armstrong, Democrat 8th, defeats Republican challenger Misty Glynn in a February 21 special election to fill the state Senate 19th district seat that now U.S. Representative Morgan McGarvey vacated to join Congress. Northern Kentucky Parents Worry a Student Who Wrote Hit List Returns by Madeline Mitchell. 1 week before Christmas, Connor High School principal Andy Wickliffe called his wife Yvonne Wickoff and told her the student who had written their son's name on a hit list would return to Connor High in Boone County after winter break. He then made 10 more calls to the parents of other children on the list, which was discovered in a journal at Connor Middle School in November 2021. School and law enforcement officials haven't made the journal public, but they have said it described how the student might commit violence against the children on the list. "That was not easy," Andy Wickoff said, more than a month after making the calls, holding his hand to his temple to cover his eyes. It was Superintendent Matthew Turner's decision to have the student return to Connor, not Wickoff's, and according to documents obtained by the Inquirer through an Open Records Act request, the decision was made without the knowledge of at least one school board member. The district had offered to help him make the calls, but Wickoff said, "I felt like the people in my school needed to hear it from me." He said some parents were nonchalant about the update after already moving their children to other schools, while some were appalled and vehemently objected to it. The student who made the list, whom the Inquirer is not naming, was expelled after he detailed specified acts of violence toward nearly a dozen of his peers in a notebook. A school resource officer in the Boone County Sheriff's Office responded once the notebook was found and said the student admitted to writing the contents of the notebook, however insisted that he was not planning to carry out the acts, but merely writing the thoughts down that were in his head. He was in eighth grade at the time. Kentucky state law says expelled students can return to public school after 1 year of expulsion through a district superintendent can determine which school they are placed in. With American school shootings broadcast on a weekly basis and local threats and spotting calls announced just as often, it's no surprise that the news out of this otherwise quiet Northern Kentucky school community spread quickly. Dozens of Connor High parents showed up to Boone County School's January school board meeting to ask why the student was sent back to the environment that had failed him. School shooting victims from out of state read about Connor High School online and reached out to Wickoff, he said, sharing their stories of trauma and hoping to prevent other students from experiencing the same fate. But to Turner, the decision is final. A revisit of a prior adjudication on a student who has served and completed all requirements of their discipline is double jeopardy. A student cannot be punished twice for the same offense, Turner wrote in an email to the Inquirer. The rest of his comments for this story included similar points that were in a district-provided statement he sent to parents earlier this month. In the statement, Turner maintains his decision is in line with Kentucky law, ensuring every student's right to a free and public education and the district's expulsion policy. But given the nuance of the situation and its impact on student safety and families' perception of their students' safety, it raises the question, even when matters are handled in line with the law, does that mean it's the right thing to do? Some Connor High students and parents, including the school's principal, don't think so. And worse, some parents feel as though Boone County School's superintendent has condescended to them about the safety of their own children. It was just a check of the box. In a parent-initiated meeting held January 2nd, 2 days before students were to return from winter break, district administrators, including Turner, sat down with some of the parents of victims named on the hit list. Just 2 days before students returned from winter break, a group of parents did request to talk with me. I met with them, heard, and understood them, Turner confirmed via email. Student privacy, however, is protected by state and federal law. Yvonne Wyckoff said it was confirmed at that meeting that the district did not consult school resource officers or victims' families in making the decision to send the student who made the hit list back to Connor High School. Turner also made clear at the meeting that he would not budge in his decision. "I felt worse coming out of that meeting than I did going into the meeting," Yvonne Wyckoff said. "It was just a checkoff of the box." Wyckoff's and some of the other parents have asked local attorney and former Kentucky State Representative Ed Massey to represent them, though there is no litigation pending at this time. Massey is also a former Boone County Schools Board of Education member. Massey confirmed Yvonne Wyckoff's summary of the January 2nd meeting to the Inquirer. He's also met with other parents and community members to discuss next steps to overturn Turner's decision. As of Wednesday, a petition on change.org asking the school board to appeal Turner's decision and remove the formerly expelled student from Connor High had more than 400 signatures. Documents. Superintendent shares plans for reintegration while community expresses fear. Turner updated Boone County Schools Board of Education members on his plan to reintegrate the formerly expelled student 2 weeks before the student returned to Connor High School, according to documents obtained by the Inquirer through an Open Records Act request. The email, dated December 20th, stated a transition team was formed last summer with administrators, counselors, teachers, and district leaders, and that the student has performed well academically and socially with the staff at another school. The plan for reintegration after winter break, Turner wrote, includes weekly meetings with the district school psychologist, in addition to regular meetings with his assigned guidance counselor and Connor's assistant principal. The plan spells out the steps in place to support the student and ensure a safe and positive atmosphere, including the personal conversations with students that were named in the original disciplinary incident and their parents, Turner wrote. In response to concerned parent, at the beginning of January, school board member Carolyn Wolf, who was sworn in at the end of November, wrote that she was not part of the decision-making process to return the student to Connor High and that she was not even aware that he was returning until the last hour of the last day of school prior to winter break. "From that point, I have been actively looking into the situation on behalf of the families that are directly involved and on behalf of our community to learn why we are where we are with this unprecedented situation," Wolf wrote in an email. Wolf declined to comment further on the issue to the Inquirer. Other emails obtained through an open records request show district parents and staff were disturbed by the superintendent's decision. "I hope he's had appropriate mental therapy, but it would be foolish to think that homicidal ideation can be completely extinguished, even with the best therapies," one email sent to Turner and another district administrator read. Adding that Turner used faulty logic that this disturbed kid's rights to an education supersedes our children's right to a safe environment. "How can you allow someone who planned to shoot and kill another student to now sit across from them in class?" another email to the district reads. "The only answer is for you to have him removed and have him removed today before anyone gets hurt and you have blood on your hands." In an email sent to Principal Wyckoff, a parent requested a class change for her child so as not to be in the same vicinity as the student who had made the list. "I know I can't protect her completely in this world, but I also do not want to sit her next to possible danger every day and open her up to doing something to him in class to get her name on his next list," the email reads. "Student named in hit list has message for child who made threats. I want him to live a good life." A 15-year-old who was named on the hit list spoke with the Inquirer about the experience. "The child does not currently attend Connor High School. The Inquirer is not naming the child because of age and status as a victim. The child who was in 8th grade at the time first heard about the list from peers but didn't know who had written it or if the scenario was real. I just remember kids like ran up and told me while I was coming out of the bathroom," the student said. "I didn't know for sure if I was on it because it was just random kids telling me that. But then eventually later my parents got told and so they then told me." Once the student found out who wrote the list, it only caused further confusion. The student said they had never spoken with the list writer and didn't know why their name would be on the list. Similarly, the Wyckoff said their son was merely an acquaintance and had no significant contact with the expelled student before the notebook was discovered. The story was twisted and rumors spread around the school, the student said. Some students erroneously said there were more than 100 names on the list when there were really 11. A December 2021 email from Connor Middle School Principal James Brewer to parents addressed those rumors and assured parents of their students' safety and claimed there was never an active threat or weapon in the building. "Please remind your children that gossiping is very much a game of telephone," Brewer wrote in the email. "The more it's talked about, the wilder and farther from the truth the story becomes, and that you can't believe everything you hear. Gossiping about rumors you heard or posting about it on social media makes you part of the problem. Gossiping creates panic and spreads inaccurate information." The student who spoke with the Inquirer said they were never offered counseling or other resources after the school told them the news in November 2021. The student said they want the person who wrote the list to live a good life. "I don't want any of this to follow him around. I want him to have friends," the student said, "but I just wish my life wasn't affected so that he could go back to school. There could have been other options to where he was safe and we were safe." Connor High School principal is a parent first. As Connor High's principal, Andy Wyckoff's duty is to ensure all students are safe, educated, and treated fairly. He said students named to the list are now being offered counseling services at the high school. Wyckoff said one of his main reservations about the formerly expelled student returning to his school is for that student's well-being. "That's what's been at the center of most of the community's feedback, too," he said. "I don't want any kid to feel unwelcome in my building," he said. But as a parent, Wyckoff's top priority is his family, his wife, son, and daughter. And the student's return puts him in a very, very, very precarious position as a parent, school administrator, and community leader. Despite it all, Wyckoff said he is remaining professional, but his wife said she's furious that the school's district administrators have put Wyckoff and the rest of their family in such a difficult situation. "If there's a law written that puts students ahead of safety, I think those laws need to be challenged or changed," Andy Wyckoff said. "I hope common sense prevails." The next regularly scheduled Boone County School Board meeting will take place February 9th, according to the district's website. Alabama kingpin sold Mexican cartel-supplied drugs. Betrayal awaited. By Beth Warren. Mexican cartel members invited Alabama drug kingpin Rolando Antoine Williamson to cross the border and solidify their business relationship with a 2019 motorcycle trip. But Williamson worried the trip could be a trap. One of his Mexican associates cautioned he might be kidnapped, beaten, and held for a $100,000 ransom. The drug associate had been kidnapped by the Gulf cartel, and his father had to sell the family home to secure his release. Williamson, then aged 33, heeded the warning and declined the invitation, but he continued trafficking kilos of cartel drugs. He may have dodged one danger, but he didn't see another one lurking closer to home. Back in Alabama, one of his drug couriers betrayed him, allowing investigators to listen in on their discussions about drug deals. An FBI North Alabama Safe Streets Task Force gathered evidence against Williamson, putting his freedom at risk. This case illustrates how, along with larger cities, Mexican cartels also target small towns and mid-sized cities far from the border, fueling and capitalizing on the deadliest drug epidemic in American history. The Courier-Journal reviewed court records and interviewed police, prosecutors, and lead FBI Special Agent Wayne Gearhart, who has since retired, to learn about Williamson's rise to power and the betrayal that imploded his drug ring. In the summer of 2019, Williamson planned to drive to Atlanta, a popular cartel transshipment point, to meet with a cartel associate to pick up another load. But FBI agents arrested Williamson, searched his home, and two other properties. Inside his home, agents found marijuana, more than 135 grams of heroin, and 150 grams of fentanyl, up to 75,000 potentially lethal doses of the top drug killing Americans. Federal grand jurors in Birmingham returned indictments against Williamson, known as the bald head, despite his thick braids, and 18 of his associates. However, agents have not been able to identify his main link to the cartel, a man only known as Meme from Monterrey, Mexico. A drug courier who was born in Mexico and worked for Williamson told agents that Meme was with the Gulf Cartel, or Cartel del Golfo, also known as CDG, which has long dominated Monterrey. Prosecutors secured a rare kingpin designation for Williamson, meaning he directed an expensive drug trafficking network that moved a high volume of drugs throughout Birmingham, especially on the west side. It also meant that if he was convicted, he faced an automatic life sentence in federal prison where parole isn't an option. They were the power on that side of town, especially Rolando. He directed a lot of people, said Gerhardt, who considers this one of the top cases of his career. Many of Williamson's associates were afraid to testify against him. He kept silent and opted to take his chances at trial. Prosecutors had a powerful case that included evidence from his phone containing messages about drug deals on WhatsApp. They also had a recording of a very revealing chat Williamson had with a Mexican business associate who became an FBI cooperating witness. Jurors also got to see photos of Williamson posing with expensive jewelry made for him by jewelers in Atlanta and Philadelphia, and large stacks of money on Snapchat. In one photo, he's wearing a large custom-made diamond and gold pendant with his initials R.A.W. above Ain't No Playin'. His fleet of cars included a Dodge Charger Hellcat and Cadillac Escalades. In April 2022, jurors convicted Williamson of running a criminal enterprise that trafficked a variety of drugs. In August, the judge sentenced Williamson, 37, to life plus 10 years in prison and added a money judgment against him totaling more than $36 million as a penalty for trafficking the fentanyl found in his home, more than 400 kilos of cocaine, more than 24 kilos of heroin, 6 kilos of methamphetamine, and more than 20,000 pounds of marijuana. Williamson is now jailed at a high-security prison in Louisiana. His attorney, John D. Lloyd, said he is working on Williamson's appeal and can't comment on the case. Williamson grew up in Bessemer, a modest suburb southwest of Birmingham with less than 32,000 residents, but had the hustle and savvy to lead the drug network blamed for supplying Birmingham's west side for years. His team of dealers and drug couriers included a trusted member of the community, a popular youth football coach known for urging his players to stay clear of drugs. Williamson wanted to be at the top, but would discover that running a drug ring has its own problems, including dangerous family squabbles, jealousy, and betrayal. It's raining money. Williamson sees an opportunity to take control. Before Rolando Williamson evolved into a drug kingpin, he dealt a smaller amount of drugs in the shadow of one of Birmingham's most flashy and notorious drug traffickers, Billy Williams Jr. Local police considered Williams, known as Champ, as the main supplier of the city's west side by 2010, and suspect he was involved in several violent crimes, including homicides, said Greg Gager, a retired FBI agent who worked as the co-lead on the Williams case. FBI agents got approval for wiretaps, listening for months as Williams discussed drug deals with associates. In a coordinated ambush in 2013, a police SWAT team burst into one of Williams' stash houses at the same time. Seven armed members of an FBI task force rushed toward Williams' luxury downtown condo in a renovated bank building. FBI Safe Streets task force member Jude Washington slammed the ram, a heavy metal ramming device, into Williams' front door three times to force it open, splintering the wood off its metal frame. He and Gerhardt were the first in, hurrying to the back bedroom. They found Williams dressed only in his underwear. Dodger and Gerhardt shoved him to the ground and handcuffed him. Washington spun around and saw a $50 bill on a bathroom window ledge. Williams had hurriedly shoved wads of $20 and $50 out of his 12th-floor bathroom window. Bills fluttered toward the ground, scattered by a slight wind. None of his partners in crime were waiting on the ground to scoop up the loot, so when a city bus driver beginning his morning shift spotted the cash, he rushed to grab what he could. Within minutes, FBI agents hurried over to get what was left and bag it as evidence. It was a theatrical ending to the long criminal career of Williams, known to local law enforcement as one of Birmingham's top drug menaces, who saturated the area with drugs for years. Inside the condo, investigators found $167,000 in stacks of cash. They don't know how much fluttered away, but estimate that it totaled hundreds or even thousands of dollars. They also found $175,000 worth of jewelry, including gold and diamond watches, two fur coats, and a fleet of upscaled cars, including a Corvette ZR1, Chrysler 300, and Cadillac CTS-V luxury sedan. Billy Williams was a bad egg, Giger said. Guys like that are dangerous. They become urban legends, and a few are willing to testify against them out of fear. Williams ended up pleading guilty and leading a cocaine and heroin trafficking network. He discussed some of his business dealings, though he never revealed his source of supply in Mexico. In July 2014, a judge sentenced him to serve nearly 22 years, which was later reduced to 19 years in federal prison. In total, Williams and a dozen others were convicted on federal drug charges, including three drug associates who initially pleaded not guilty and wanted to take their chance at trial. A jury was in place in 2014 when everything changed. Jurors were sent to the jury room so the prosecution could bring Williams before the judge to authenticate the FBI wiretaps, admitting that he was one of the voices in the recordings. Williams wore an orange jail jumpsuit and was bound by shackles and handcuffs as he shuffled into the courtroom, flanked by deputy U.S. Marshals. As he began to pass by the defense table, he briefly paused and looked at each of the three defendants in the eye without saying a word. The attorneys and agents were stunned as all three defendants, before opening statements, stopped their trials and pleaded guilty. Gerhardt, who retired after 23 years with the Bureau, said he had never seen anything like it. No one is sure if the defendants were scared of Williams or if they just knew from the look on his face that he was going to spill all their secrets and secure their convictions. With Williams in prison, there was an opening for control of the large drug network, and one of his relatives was expected to take over. But the relative sold heroin to undercover agents and ended up in his own prison cell. That left the ambitious Rolando Williamson, who decided to grab that top spot for himself. In time, he grew the drug network to an even larger organization and established close ties to Mexican suppliers. But while he was building his drug network, FBI agents were building a case against him. An informant told them Williamson was one of Williams' customers, and agents found his number listed on Williams' phone logs. Eventually, some of his trusted associates betrayed him, helping investigators dethrone Williamson and topple the drug ring. Warnings and betrayals. He's just jealous of me. A secret recording gave investigators a glimpse at the inner workings of Williamson's drug ring, including details about a drug ripoff, a warning about a possible kidnapping, and a desire to order a revenge killing. They were able to listen in on a June 11, 2019 meeting he had with a drug associate from Mexico because the associate became a cooperating witness for the government and agreed to wear a wire. Williamson told the drug courier to deal directly with him and to avoid contact with his cousin, who used to be his right-hand man. Williamson said he no longer trusted the relative after learning that his cousin was talking about having him followed. Williamson said he wanted to retaliate, but couldn't because of the family link. "He's just jealous of me," Williamson said. "I was ready to kill his ass for real." "If you got folks from 280, that's all they want to do, buy dope," Williamson told the drug courier, referring to customers near the U.S. 280 Southeast Corridor with affluent subdivisions between Birmingham and Auburn. "I promise we can make a lot of money. I'll buy the dope, and we just sell it to them." Williamson told the drug courier about me, his supplier in Mexico, and about the invitation to go to Monterey and ride motorcycles. The courier, who is from Reynosa, Mexico, across the border from Hidalgo, Texas, cautioned against it. "It's a lot of tourist people in Monterey, but it's still dangerous. Me being your homeboy, I'll say don't try." The drug courier, who lived in Birmingham, revealed how he previously had been deported, and when he got to Reynosa, a truck pulled up that looked similar to Williamson's. When the door opened, he realized it was a cartel member and not Williamson behind the wheel. He was freed after his father sold the family home to pay a $20,000 ransom. He also said one of his cousins was robbed of a drug lord load in Atlanta and owed the cartel money. He said cartel members tried to find a relative of the cousins in Mexico to murder for revenge, but the last known relative, his grandfather, had died before they could kill him. The cartel knows Williamson, as head of a drug network in the U.S., is more powerful and would likely extort him for closer to $100,000 or end up killing him, the man warned. Williamson avoided the trip but kept trafficking cartel drugs until his arrest 2 months later. Relatives and friends submitted letters to the judge describing Williamson as a loving family man who generously gave to others in need. During the sentencing hearing, U.S. District Court Judge Anne Marie Carney Axon cautioned, "My concern is that you have left these young women and men with the impression that it's okay to sell drugs, so long as you're generous with your proceeds. Remind them that the money that you spent on them, whilst being a big deal, led to tremendous pain. For, I'm sure, many people, most particularly those who received your fentanyl." This concludes readings for the first section of the Courier-Journal for this Saturday, February 4th, 2023. Stay tuned for the Metro section to follow immediately. Your reader has been Melody Ryan. Now to continue reading from the Courier-Journal for Saturday, February 4th, 2023, starting with the Metro section. Your reader is Melody Ryan. We will start with the obituaries. We read only the name, age, and city. If you would like further information on any of the obituaries, please call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390, and we will be glad to read the entire obituary for you. I will repeat that number at the end of the listings. Terrell Terry L. Black, 77, Louisville. Roxanne Conway, 63, Shepherdsville. Leona Crane, 73, Campbellsville. Benny E. Denning, 70, Richmond. Michael Douglas Gilmore, 77, Owensboro. Mary Ann Piles Warren, 80, Hanover. Nancy C. Skirvin Howard, 83, Madison. Delma Ray Butler Hutchins, 83, Owensboro. Gilbert Jeffries Sr., 85, Shepherdsville. David Scott Jones, 60, Stanford. James William Kidd, 69, Waynesburg. Denise Ann McCoy, 59, No City. Elizabeth Jane Mullen, 73, Drakesboro. Mark Mullins, 66, Milton. David Glenn Newton, 72, Bardstown. Elizabeth Betty Parker, 93, Sellersburg, Indiana. Marvin Polesgrove, 94, Frankfort. Tabitha Nicole Prather, 34, Louisville. William J. Reese, 77, Richmond. Margaret Day Eldridge Sams, 87, Somerset. Larry Schaus, 69, Deputy. Michael Joe Thompson, 58, Lebanon Junction. Bill J. Winninger, 80, Glasgow. If you would like further information about any of the listings today, call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390, and we will be glad to read the entire item to you. Sushi Restaurant Plans to Expand, by Matthew Glowicki. A sushi concept that first launched at Logan Street Market is gearing up for an expansion. Daisuke Sushi plans to open a second location, a sit-down restaurant and bar, at 1604 Bardstown Road in the former Faces Bar Bistro space. Owner Natalia Resnick opened Daisuke Sushi at Logan Street Market, 1001 Logan Street, in October 2020 after years of working in the kitchens of other Louisville sushi spots. Getting through the early COVID period was horrible, she said, but the eatery has managed to attract a loyal customer base. Now we're doing great, and we have a lot of customers, so that's why we've decided to have another location that's bigger, and have a full restaurant, she said, noting she'll continue to operate at the market. Already set up as a restaurant, the new location, which will feature an expanded menu and bar, was also attractive for Resnick for its relative proximity to Logan Street Market. It's a good location to do the business, she said. There's a lot of people walking around, a lot of traffic. Stout Burgers and Beer previously operated at the location from 2015 to late 2019. Faces Bar Bistro opened in 2020, pivoting from an Asian-inspired tapas concept to a carryout-friendly pizza menu, and closed in early 2022. Resnick, who is originally from Thailand, said she'll draw on her Thai roots in differentiating her menu from a number of nearby sushi restaurants along Bardstown Road. She's hoping to open the second location in late February and expressed gratitude for her customers seeing her through a challenging start. "Some of my friends, they said I'm crazy," she said of her decision to open in 2020, "but I have to do what I have to do. If you never start it, you'll never know. You have to try." Site offers variety of unique selections. Location to hold grand reopening Saturday after month-long revamp by Kirby Adams. While the Kentucky Derby Museum gift shop has all the usual t-shirts, keychains, and ball caps, it is also a gold mine for one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else, or at least all under one roof. Saturday, the gift store will celebrate a grand reopening after a month-long renovation, and the first 50 shoppers will receive a free 149th Kentucky Derby glass. "We have so many unique items in the store that it's not only museum visitors who shop here," said Christina Jared, Director of Retail Operations. "We have a lot of shoppers throughout the year who live right here in Louisville and come by to buy gifts, pick up items for Derby-themed parties, or items for themselves." The store has seen significant growth over the past couple of years. Sales are up nearly 17% from 2021 to 2022, with 48% of the merchandise now coming from Kentucky vendors, Jared said. "I find a lot of wonderful products by visiting art shows and craft fairs around the state. I also keep an eye out for interesting items when I am shopping in local shops and boutiques in the Louisville area," Jared said. The well-dressed horse racing fan can find a large variety of hats for both men and women in the shop, as well as equine jewelry, men's neckwear, home decor, party supplies, and even locally made horse-themed games. The gift shop also carries a solid offering of local bourbons, bourbon balls, and other Kentucky-made food items, along with more usual items like brightly colored drink koozies decorated with numbers from the starting gate. "One customer bought one of every number for a derby party and used the koozies for a party game," Jared said. "We had the mother of a bride buy derby glasses for guests to drink from at the wedding reception." According to Jared, when it comes to derby glasses, customers purchase specific glasses for one of three reasons. They buy it to commemorate the year they attended the Kentucky Derby, or because it's the year they were born, or the year Secretariat won the Derby, she said. For those who prefer to shop from home, 70% of the Kentucky Derby Museum gift store's inventory is available on the website. That includes one of the most popular items in the gift store, the Dirty Horseshoe, for $8. "It's an actual horseshoe with dirt from the Churchill Downs racetrack embedded in the grooves," Jared said. The Kentucky Derby Museum store is inside the front door of the Kentucky Derby Museum, 704 Central Avenue. The store is open during regular museum hours, and museum admission is not required to visit the store. The Kentucky Derby Museum is open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Sunday, noon to 5 p.m. Companies join Fed Road Safety Effort. Campaign aims to tackle crisis of traffic deaths, by Hope Yin. Nearly 50 businesses and nonprofits, including rideshare companies Uber and Lyft, industrial giant 3M, and automaker Honda, are pledging millions of dollars in initiatives to stem a crisis in road fatalities under a new federal effort announced Friday. It's part of the Department of Transportation's Call to Action campaign, which urges commitments from the private sector, trade groups, and health and safety organizations to reduce serious traffic injuries and deaths. Traffic fatalities are near historic high after surges of dangerous driving during the coronavirus pandemic. The public-private effort, unveiled Friday as part of the department's multi-year strategy, started last year to make roads safer. Ranges from investments to improve school crosswalks to enhanced seatbelt alerts in Uber vehicles, and a partnership between Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to promote proven injury prevention strategies, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg told the Associated Press. It comes on the heels of the award of 510 transportation grants this week, totaling more than $800 million under the bipartisan infrastructure law to states and localities that for the first time focus on road safety, such as by adding bike lanes, lighting, and protected left turns and sidewalks. After a record spike in 2021, the number of U.S. traffic deaths dipped slightly during the first 9 months of 2022, but pedestrians and cyclist deaths continued to rise. More than 40,000 people are killed in road crashes a year. It is still a crisis, Buttigieg said, stressing a need for a national change in mindset. We're looking at road deaths coming in year after year in a similar proportion to gun deaths. The problem is they're so widespread and so common that I fear, as a country, we've gotten used to it and perhaps fallen into the mistaken sense they're inevitable. We can't solve any of this on our own, he added. We also know there isn't one piece that will get all this down, but if we add all this together, it can be enormous. Road travelers will see an array of safety measures this year. Uber told the AP that it is donating $500,000, its single biggest investment in its effort to reduce drunken driving, for free and discounted rides in Colorado, Georgia, Illinois, Missouri, and Texas as part of the Decide to Ride program, run in tandem with MAD and Anheuser-Busch. The world's largest rideshare company also said it was doubling the availability of its bike lane alerts this month from 71 cities to 144 for passengers exiting vehicles near cycling routes and providing a safety checklist for Uber Eats bicycle couriers. It also pledged to strengthen its seatbelt alerts, such as by increasing their frequency or adding an audio message along with pop-up messages urging riders to buckle up. We were thinking about how we could make an impact more broadly, how we can get people to start making better choices, said Kristen Smith, head of Uber's road safety policy. We know it's going to take a broad coalition of people to be tackling the crisis on U.S. roadways right now. Uber's investment comes along with commitments from Lyft, the second largest rideshare company, which has partnered with the Governor's Highway Safety Association in recent years to award state grants to help reduce impaired driving and curtail speeding. 3M, the maker of Post-it notes, industrial coatings, and ceramics, told the AP it was continuing its partnership with state transportation agencies to identify the best technology to make road signs and lane markings more visible and reflective. It's already pledged to improve 100 school crossing zones and added to that commitment of $250,000 this year for a new transportation equity initiative that will fund half a dozen major projects in underserved areas. The company cited as an example its partnership with nonprofit groups to help build out Providence, Rhode Island's Hope Street urban trail last year, featuring new bike and pedestrian lanes connecting the neighborhood to schools and the commercial district. Dan Chen, president of 3M's Transportation Safety Division, praised the federal government's call for action as the right approach that will allow companies like 3M to work in sync with policymakers and other stakeholders to make roads safer for drivers, pedestrians, and cyclists. Other businesses and groups joining the effort include American Honda Motor Corp, which pledged continuing efforts and investments totaling $2 million to improve teen driver safety, UPS, which will install automatic emergency braking on its newer big delivery vehicles, and the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, a trade group which will step up its push for industry adoption of safety technologies such as auto high beam. The Transportation Department said it was issuing an open call for pledges, and more companies were expected to join in the coming weeks. Buttigieg, noting the need for a sustained multi-year effort to substantially reduce traffic fatalities, emphasized the opportunities as well with President Joe Biden's five-year $1 trillion infrastructure law and said much more work remained to rebuild public works and improve people's livelihoods. I definitely have 4 years worth of items and then some, he said, speaking of his job as transportation secretary. Texas power woes linger as Northeast girds for freeze, by Ken Miller and David Sharp. Rising temperatures offered hope Friday for frustrated Texans days after they lost power, and in many cases heat in a deadly winter storm, while a new wave of frigid weather rolling into the Northeast led communities to close schools and open warming centers. Wind chills in some higher elevations of the Northeast could punch below minus 50 degrees as an Arctic front swept in from Canada, forecasters said. In Texas, Austin officials compared damage from fallen trees and iced over power lines to tornadoes as they came under criticism for slow repairs and shifting timelines to restore power. More than 240,000 customers across the state lacked power early Friday, down from 430,000 on Thursday, according to PowerOutage.us. Our heat source is our fireplace, and we've been in bed snuggled up under like five or six blankets, Edward Dolly of Spring Branch, southwest of Austin, told KSAT-TV. Just think that our utility companies need to do a better job making sure our infrastructure is maintained properly. Pauline Farage, also of Spring Branch, told KSAT that she had no way to prepare a meal without electricity and that she worries about the cost of replacing hundreds of dollars of spoiled food. As the storm swept over this week, the indoor temperature fell to 29 degrees and the sounds of tree limbs breaking unsettled her. Power failures were most widespread in Austin. Impatience rose there among nearly 123,000 customers days after the electricity first went out. Thursday night, officials backtracked on early estimates that power would be fully restored by Friday evening. Damage was worse than originally calculated, they said, and they could no longer provide an estimate. The city let its citizens down. The situation is unacceptable to the community, and it's unacceptable to me, Austin Mayor Kirk Watson, a Democrat, said in a news conference Friday. And I'm sorry. The outages recall the 2021 blackouts in Texas when hundreds of people died after the state's power grid was pushed to the brink of total failure because of a lack of generation. There have been no new reports of deaths from this week's power outage, though the storm and freeze have been blamed for at least 12 traffic fatalities on slick roads in Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. In New England, temperatures began plunging Friday morning. The worst part of the upcoming cold snap is going to be the wind, which has already topped 80 miles per hour in higher elevations, said National Weather Service lead forecaster Bob Orovic. Frigid wind chills and the combined effect of wind and cold air on exposed skin are expected Saturday. The worst wind chills in the populated areas of the Northeast shouldn't go lower than minus 40, he said. Gusts as high as 40 miles per hour raised the prospect of power outages in Maine, and communities began opening warming stations. Even cold weather sports were curtailed. Some ski resorts scaled back operations, eliminating night skiing and reducing lift operations. Schools closed Friday in Boston and in Manchester, New Hampshire. The system is expected to move out of the region Sunday. UK to launch probe on Omagh bombing by Jill Wallace. The UK government said Thursday will hold a public inquiry into whether the deadliest bombing in Northern Ireland's decades of violence could have been prevented. Northern Ireland's Secretary Chris Heaton-Harris announced a judge-led independent probe of the 1998 car bombing in the town of Omagh that killed 29 people, including a woman pregnant with twins, and wounded hundreds more. An Irish Republican Army dissident group, the Real IRA, claimed responsibility. A court in 2021 ordered the government to investigate in response to a legal challenge by Michael Gallagher, whose son Aidan was killed by the 500-pound bomb. Gallagher alleges that intelligence failings allowed a preventable atrocity to occur in a busy market town. Heaton-Harris said the inquiry will focus specifically on the four grounds which the court held as giving rise to plausible arguments that the bombing could have been prevented, including whether security services had advanced intelligence of the bomb and whether they could have disrupted the plot. The inquiry is likely to take 2 years and potentially much longer. The inquirers will have the power to order evidence to be handed over and to compel witnesses to testify under oath. Heaton-Harris said he hoped the decision to conduct an independent inquiry gives some comfort to those families who have long campaigned for this outcome. Gallagher said the inquiry would let bereaved families hopefully get the answers that we need and we can move on. If we don't have this process for the rest of our lives, we're going to wonder what if, he said. The 2021 court ruling said that a new investigation should be held in the Republic of Ireland, where most of the suspect bombers were based. The Irish government said it would consider what further action is required on our part after the British announcement. The attack on August 15, 1998, came months after the Good Friday Peace Accords largely ended 3 decades of conflicts known as the Troubles. Drone hit Iran's site, damage seen. Tehran says Israel was behind January 28th attack. John Gambrell. Satellite photos analyzed by the Associated Press on Friday showed damage done to what Iran describes as a military workshop targeted by Israeli drones, the latest such assault amid a shadow war between the two countries. While Iran has offered no explanations yet of what the workshop manufactured, the drone attack threatened to raise tensions in the region again. Already, worries have grown over Tehran enriching uranium closer than ever to weapons-grade levels, with a top United Nations nuclear official warning that the Islamic Republic had enough fuel to build several atomic bombs if it chooses. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whose earlier tenure as premier saw escalating attacks targeting Iran, has returned to office and reiterated that he views Tehran as his country's top security threat. With State Department spokesperson Ned Price now declaring Iran has killed the opportunity to return to its nuclear deal with world powers, it remains unclear what diplomacy immediately could ease the tensions between Tehran and the West. Cloudy weather had prevented satellite pictures of the site of the workshop since it came under attack by what Iran described as bomb-carrying quadcopters on the night of January 28th. Quadcopters, which get their name from having four rotors, typically operate from short ranges by remote control. Video taken of the attack showed an explosion at the site after anti-aircraft fire targeted the drones, with the explosion likely the result of one of the drones reaching the building's roof. Iran's military has claimed it shot down two other drones before they reached the site. Images taken Thursday by Planet Labs PBC showed the workshop in Esfahan, a central Iranian city some 215 miles south of Tehran. An AP analysis of the image compared to earlier images of the workshop showed damage to the structure's roof. That damage corresponded to footage aired by Iranian state television immediately after the attack that showed at least two holes in the building's roof. The Iranian state TV footage, as well as satellite photos, suggests the roof also may have been built with so-called slat armor. The structure resembles a cage built around roofs or armored vehicles to stop direct detonation from rockets, missiles, or bomb-carrying drones against a target. Installation of such protection at the workshop suggests Iran believed it could be a drone target. Iran's intelligence ministry in July claimed to have broken up a plot to target sensitive areas around Ifshan. A segment aired on Iranian state TV in October included purported confessions by alleged members of Kamala, a Kurdish opposition party that is expelled from Iran and now lives in Iraq, that they planned to target a military aerospace facility in Ifshan after being trained by Israel's Mossad intelligence service. It remains unclear whether the military workshop targeted in the drone attack was that aerospace facility. Iran's mission to the United Nations told the AP on Friday night that technical information isn't available about the workshop. All of Iran's military and nuclear facilities are protected by air defense because they've always been under threat, the mission added. The attack comes as Iran's theocratic government faces challenges at home and abroad. Nationwide protests have shaken the country since the September death of Mahsa Amini, a Kurdish-Iranian woman detained by the country's morality police. Its rial currency has plummeted to new lows against the U.S. dollar. Meanwhile, Iran continues to arm Russia with the bomb-carrying drone that Moscow uses in attacks in Ukraine on power plants and civilian targets. Israel is suspected of launching a series of attacks on Iran, including an April 2021 assault on its underground Natanz nuclear facility that damaged its centrifuges. In 2020, Iran blamed Israel for a sophisticated attack that killed its top military nuclear scientist. Israel has not commented on this drone attack. However, Israeli officials rarely acknowledge operations carried out by the country's secret military units or the Mossad. A letter published Thursday by Iran's ambassador to the UN, Amir Saeed Ivani, said that early investigations suggest that the Israeli regime was responsible for this attempted attack of aggression. The letter, however, did not elaborate on what evidence supported Iran's suspicion. Report: January brings surprise burst of hiring. Broad-based job gains have economists baffled, by Paul Wiseman. For nearly a year, the Federal Reserve has been on a mission to cool down the job market to help curb the nation's worst inflation bout in four decades. The job market hasn't been cooperating. Consider what happened in January. The government said Friday that employers added a sizzling 517,000 jobs last month and that the unemployment rate dipped to 3.4%, the lowest level since 1969. The job gain was so large it left economists scratching their heads and wondering why the Fed's aggressive interest rate hikes haven't slowed hiring at a time when many foresee a recession nearing. Friday's report instead added to the picture of a resilient U.S. labor market with low unemployment, relatively few layoffs, and many job openings. Though good for workers, employers' steady demand for labor has also helped accelerate wage growth and contributed to high inflation. But the Fed's inflation watchers might be reassured somewhat by January's wage data. Average hourly pay rose 4.4% last month from a year earlier, slower than the 4.8% year-over-year increase in December. And from December to January, wages rose 0.3%, below the 0.4% increase the previous month. On top of the sizzle in job growth it reported for January, the government on Friday also revised up its estimate of the gains in November and December by a combined 71,000. January's hiring was broad-based across industries. A category that includes restaurants and bars added 99,000 workers. Professional and business services jobs, including bookkeepers and consultants, rose by 82,000. Governments added 74,000, boosted by the end of a worker strike against California's state university system. Healthcare added 58,000 jobs, retailers 30,000, construction added 25,000 jobs, manufacturing added 19,000. Economists had collectively estimated that the economy added just 185,000 jobs last month. "This is a labor market on heat," said Seema Shah, chief global strategist at Principal Asset Management. "It would be difficult," she suggested, "to see the Fed stop raising rates and entertain ideas of rate cuts when there is such an explosive economic news coming in. January's job growth far exceeded December's 260,000 total and extended a streak of substantial gains. In part out of concern that those job gains would keep inflation high, the Fed has raised its key rate 8 times since March to try to contain inflation, which hit a 40-year high last year but has slowed since then. Companies are still seeking more workers and are hanging tightly on to the ones they have. Putting aside some high-profit layoffs at big tech companies like Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and others, most workers are enjoying an unusual level of job security even at a time when many economists foresee a recession approaching. For all of 2022, the economy had added a sizzling average of roughly 375,000 jobs a month. That was a pace vigorous enough to have contributed to the painful inflation Americans have endured. A tight job market tends to put upward pressure on wages, which in turn feeds into inflation. This concludes excerpts from the Courier-Journal for Saturday, February 4th, 2023. Your reader has been Melody Ryan. Please stay tuned for continued programming on Radio Live.